strongly coupled of new strong interactions. And even before getting into those, I want to go a little bit more over things about QCD. But even before I get to that, I just want to remind you of something that we went over in the first week, having to do with Goldstone bosons. And the simplest theory, the simplest four-dimensional quantum field theory where you get Goldstone bosons coming out, is just a simple U1 theory with spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this potential is the usual, I'll just draw it, one slice of it. So this potential is just the usual so-called Weinbaudel potential that looks like this. It's minimized at V away from the origin. And if you look at the space of vacuum configurations, they correspond to the average value of the field being non-zero with a potential phase. And the potential phase corresponds to the fact that I can think of the potential in the full complex phi plane as just being this rotated around. So if you like, as I rotate around, I see that I have a circle of minima. And this circle of minima is parameterized by beta. Now, to get a consistent quantum field theory, we need to choose one minimum and expand around that. So let's just choose the beta equals zero minimum and expand there. And when we do that, one way to parameterize the field in that expansion is using a radial mode and an angular mode. So this thing corresponds to our vacuum state with beta equals to zero and the limit of r and a going to zero. And I can write out my effective Lagrangian in terms of this new set of fields. And I find I get a nice canonical kinetic term for del r, for r, a nice canonical kinetic term for a, plus a built-in interaction with r. And then I get a potential that only depends on v of r. And if I look at the mass term generated in this v, the mass term is on the order of the expectation value v. On the other hand, I don't have any mass term for a, and a is the massless Goldstone. And from this point of view, my theory, the massless state corresponds to just the fact that I have a flat direction along the circle of minima, whereas the radial mode gets a mass from the curvature. So for this theory, if we look at it at low energies, at very low energies, the R state is going to be heavy, and I'm going to be left with only the Goldstone boson. So at low energies, I can more or less ignore the state. I can integrate it out. And integrating it out at leading order just gives me a free field theory with del A. But when I integrate it out, in principle, I can also get higher dimensional operators involving the A field that are suppressed by powers of 1 over V. But in any case, this picture of Goldstone bosons is, and this will generalize this in a second, is you expand your field in a radial mode, and in some modes it look like the symmetry transformation, in this case a U1 transformation. I write my field in such a way that it looks like a symmetry transformation, or at least a broken symmetry transformation acting on the vacuum state. And when I do that, typically the thing that comes out in terms of the field is the Goldstone boson. So we're going to do this in a second. And one other thing I want to emphasize here is that even though we have spontaneous symmetry breaking, this theory still realizes the initial phase symmetry, the initial phi rephases symmetry, in the sense that this Lagrangian is invariant under, well, not changing r, but shifting a nonlinearly. So we say that in this spontaneously broken phase, the symmetry is still present, but it's not obviously present. It's not explicit like it was in the initial state. Instead, it's realized in this sort of funny nonlinear way that isn't obvious at all. So we're going to do the same game for QCD. And in QCD, we can identify what's essentially a maximal global symmetry. There's an SC2 left, an SC2 right, and a U1V. So the SC2 left corresponds to QL going to L, QL, where L is an SC2 matrix. The SU2 right corresponds to only changing QR. And then the U1V just corresponds to an equal rephasing of the left and right-handed pieces. QL goes to e to the I alpha QL. QR goes to e to the, let's make sure I get this right. like so. So we have these global symmetries, and we see that some fraction of the global symmetries is broken by this expectation value. So recall that here's our QCD theory with two quarks, in this case, QL and QR. Just to remind you, QL and QR are left and right-handed doublets. And we want to write down a low energy effective theory that maintains the symmetry structure, but takes into account the fact that I'm spontaneous breaking. But on top of that, I can do a little bit better. I can look at what fraction of this initial global symmetry is broken. And it turns out that the fraction of the initial global symmetry that's broken, or the part that's unbroken, is that if I take this, I can think of this as a transformation on the vacuum that takes 1 to L1 R dagger. So if I act an SU2 left cross SU2 right transformation on this, a general one, I take this thing, which corresponds to the identity in the space, to left 1 R dagger. So my vacuum isn't invariant. I have spontaneous breaking. In the same way that if I went over here and I looked at this vacuum, if I applied a phase transformation to this, my vacuum isn't invariant either. So spontaneous symmetry breaking corresponds to a non-invariant vacuum. This is what I have here. And because I have because I'm spontaneously breaking a symmetry, I expect to have Goldstone bosons. And the Goldstone bosons correspond to the set of symmetry generators that don't respect the vacuum structure. So I can check what fraction of the symmetry does respect this form. And it turns out the breaking pattern is SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1 V goes to SU2 V cross U1 V. And SU2V is a subgroup of SU2 left cross SU2 right, such that left is equal to right. And it's obvious that if left and right are the same matrix, that leaves the vacuum, this vacuum state invariant. So our goal is to write a theory of the low energy degrees of freedom. And our generic expectation is that most stuff is going to get mass of the order of lambda QCD, except for the Goldstone bosons. The things that will be parametrically light will correspond to the Goldstone bosons, corresponding to this spontaneous breakdown of a global symmetry. So we want to try to write down an effective theory of the Goldstone bosons. And we want to build in a few features. So the main feature is that it should respect this full symmetry structure in the same way that in our theory with the A field, there we had the R, but you can think of integrating out the R. But the story there is that we still maintain the full symmetry structure, but in a funny nonlinear way. We want to do the same thing here. And ideally, we'd like to do that such that we maintain this part of the symmetry linearly, but that the rest of the symmetry is realized nonlinearly. So it turns out that one way to do this, there isn't a unique way, but one way to do this, is to use the following field variables. I call them sigma of x. This is what I introduced last time, that have the form pi a of x, ta over f. So I'll come back later to figure out what this f scale is. But f is just some dimension one coupling. This is an SU2 generator. And these are my new fields. So I have 3 pi a fields. And together, they form this sigma field. And the reason this is nice, well, this is nice for two reasons. The first is that in the limit where the pi's go to 0, this becomes a 2x2 unit matrix. And a 2x2 unit matrix is precisely what our vacuum looks like. So to get Goldstones out, to get a theory that seems to have the right structure to get Goldstones, recall that the Goldstone that came out here looks like a symmetry transformation on the vacuum with beta equal to 0. So we're going to guess that this SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1 is realized on this field in the following form. That sigma of x transforms to L sigma of x R dagger. And if we parameterize our left and right transformations as follows, as a piece that looks like a so-called axial piece, a piece that looks like a vector piece, this is just a way to parameterize two SE2 matrices. But one thing that's obvious is that if the CAs vanish, these matrices correspond to the SE2V subgroup. So we saw that if CAA equals to 0, then sigma goes to V sigma V dagger, which you can show corresponds to, when everything clears, it's just exponential 2i v pi a ta v dagger over f. And if you expand this out, you see that this thing corresponds to a linear transformation on the pi a's. So this piece, if you expand it out in V for small CBVs, this corresponds to pi A goes to pi A 1 plus something. So it's a linear transformation. On the other hand, if we look at the pieces with the CBV equal to 0, this takes some more work, but it's straightforward to do if you just expand everything out to linear order in the transformation parameters. You can show that the pi field transforms to some new pi field, which in terms of the old pi field just corresponds to pi plus f caa taa. So for this axial piece, the so-called, or at least for the pieces that correspond to generators that aren't in the SU2V subgroup, we see that this is a nonlinear shift. And this is exactly what we expect for Goldstone bosons. So this form, at this point, it's not obvious where it comes from, but it has some nice features. So the nice features are that this piece transforms in a well-defined way under the original symmetry. And in fact, it transforms in the same way as a vacuum. And it also has a nice feature that these things, the fields that make up this piece, that look like, if you like, parameterizing deviations from the vacuum, second, transform linearly under the vector part, nonlinearly under the parts that aren't vector. And this structure matches up with what we had for Goldstones. Yeah.
Can we think of sigma x as a cosine space of the SU2 del cross SU2 right cross divided by SU2 vector?
Yes, yeah. So okay, I'm not using those words, but yes. Okay, so one more thing. Let me mention this in passing. If you think about formulating quantum field theories in terms of a path integral, one of the nice things about this picture is that you see that you're just doing an integration over all possible configurations with some, let's say, some operator inserted in it if you want an expectation value. But the thing with integrals is that the thing you're integrating over corresponds to a dummy index, in the sense that you can change variables and you still get the same answer, but it looks different. So from this point of view, the fields that you use in a quantum field theory are just a set of variables. And there are lots of different choices of variables. Some are easier to use than others, but there isn't one perfect variable. So what we're doing here is we're trying to build an effective low energy Lagrangian, or we will in a second. And this choice of sigma field corresponds to a nice set of variables. So it's a nice set of variables in that we have the right number of degrees of freedom to match up the Goldstone bosons. It has nice symmetry properties that seem to agree. But this choice of variables isn't unique. And what I mean to emphasize here is that any choice of variables whatsoever that you choose to build up your action, as long as it realizes the symmetry structure in the right way, and you write down all possible operators consistent with the symmetry, And you fix those operators by matching them to the high energy theory or experimentally. Any of those theories is just as good as any of the others. So even though this might seem like a kind of a funny choice, there's a lot of kind of background structure that's gone into this choice. And it happens to be a convenient one, but it's not unique. So if you had another choice in mind, as long as you got the symmetry structure right and the right number of degrees of freedom right, those variables should be just fine as well. So OK, but we're going to go with these ones because they happen to be a nice set of degrees of freedom. OK, oh, and just in passing, to bounce off what Tiber said, we had some original group G. Our original group G is this SC2 left plus SC2 right plus U1V. And we're breaking this down to a smaller subgroup H. And that means that these Goldstone bosons, sometimes people say, live in the so-called coset space G mod H. So in other words, the stuff that lives in G that can't be mapped onto an element of H correspond to the Broken generators. And these Goldstone boson pi A fields are essentially going to correspond to those generators. OK, so our next step is to use these variables that I claim are somewhat nice and try to build an effective Lagrangian. And the effective Lagrangian, OK, well, so the first thing we want to get in our effective Lagrangian is a reasonable kinetic term for pi A. This is always the first thing you want to get for your quantum field theory. But we also want to make sure that our theory is consistent with the symmetry structure, and in particular, the full symmetry structure of SC2 left plus SC2 right. And one nice candidate you can think about writing down is d mu psi dagger, d mu psi, which, if you look at how it transforms under these global symmetry transformations, transforms into r d mu psi dagger, d mu psi, r dagger. So OK, this isn't invariant. But if you want something that's invariant, all we need to do is take the trace. So our leading, I'm going to call this L sub p squared, but the leading term in our Lagrangian for the theory, I'm going to take to be f squared over 4 trace. And here's a trace over the SU2 indices, because remember, these things are formally matrix fields. Trace w psi dagger, w psi. And thanks to the cyclicity of the trace, this is invariant under the full SU2 left cross SU2 right. And the reason I have this normalization, f squared over 4, is that if I expand this out in terms of the pi fields, you'll see that at leading order, you get a nice canonical kinetic term for pi. But if you keep on going in the expansion, you also find non-trivial interactions. So the first non-trivial interaction has the following form. Trace w pi a, pi a. And you can keep on expanding arbitrarily. Okay, it's a straightforward but tedious thing to do. And so this thing is just a nice canonical kinetic term. This piece has a form of a four-point interaction with two derivatives. So if I was to think about the structure of this, it corresponds to a four-point interaction. But the derivatives, when I Fourier transform this, are going to bring down momentum. So this thing is going to look like a vertex of the form p squared over m squared. And if I was to keep on expanding, I get things with more derivatives and more powers of 1 over f squared. And the higher order terms are going to look like this, but with higher powers. So I keep on going up and up and up. And I see that, OK, but beyond my kinetic term, I have these interactions and higher order interactions and higher order interactions. And these higher order interactions are coming in the form of p squared over f squared, which means that at least for small p compared to f, I only keep a finite number of terms. On top of that, as I go higher and higher and higher in the expansion, this is already a non-normalizable operator. But in any case, as long as I stick to small p squared, this theory makes sense. I can compute interactions, and I can trust the story perturbatively. Now, one more comment. Okay, maybe I'll just leave it at that. Okay, so in any case, this is our basic theory, and this is the leading order term we can write down. You can imagine writing down other forms that are consistent with the symmetries that may have more derivatives and so on, but this is the leading piece. One other thing we can check in this leading piece is that, or at least in the interactions that come out of it, are that if I apply these transformations, because I only have pi fields, under the under the Broca generators, where I have a shift, all the terms with interactions come in with at least one derivative of pi. And that means that the pieces with shifts all vanish because these are global shifts. And that means that this thing also has built in a shift symmetry. So for example, the reason why I don't just have a regular pi to the fourth term is that wouldn't be consistent with a shift symmetry, where a pi squared over s squared is consistent. For the same reason, I don't have a mass term. I don't have a mass term because a mass term would just be a pi squared that wouldn't be consistent with the shift symmetry. So this, I claim, is my theory of Goldstone bosons. It comes out of this simplified picture of QCD, with where I'm treating the up and down quarks as massless, and I'm ignoring all the other quarks. And okay, so I have three Goldstone bosons. And the question now is, does this actually correspond to what I see experimentally? So I know QCD experimentally looks like quarks and gluons at high energies, but what do I see at low energies? And it turns out that this story does give a good description. So for
some estimates of pi and
So the sigma field is dimensionless, and the F is dimension one. And that corresponds to pi being of dimension one. So in other words, all the stuff was chosen such that this pi has dimension one, as it should for a four-dimensional scalar. Yeah.
So if he had written down like other terms consistent with the shift symmetry, which I presume would involve more derivatives, would I have to introduce new constants analogous to that?
So we'll come back to, I'll come back in a second to identify what F is physically. So the reason I put in the F squared here was simply to cancel off the F coming from here to get a right kinetic term. And then all the other terms in the expansion are then fixed in terms of that relative thing. We'll come back in a little bit about how to describe higher order terms and what to put in there. But the answer is going to be roughly F, or 1 over F. Okay, so the next thing we want to do is try to connect this story to real QCD. And one thing that we have in real QCD that I haven't yet included in, oops, I forgot my. So one thing I haven't yet included in my toy QCD theory is electromagnetism. So electromagnetism is actually going to be a source of explicit breaking of this global symmetry. And the reason for that is under electromagnetism, the up and down quarks are going to have different charges. Whereas under SU2 left or SU2 right, they transform into each other. And that means that I'm treating the parts of some things that transform into each other differently, and that corresponds to an explicit breaking. And another way to see this is you can look at the generator of electromagnetism. So I'll write this as QEM, electromagnetic generator. You can show that this is actually embedded within this bigger symmetry group, in the sense that it corresponds to a T3L plus T3R plus 1/6 times the identity. So for example, if I was to look at U left would be a T3 left of 1/2. So 1/2 plus 1/6 gives me the 2/3. I could do the same thing for U right. In that case, the T3 right would contribute plus 1/6. Or for the downs, I would have minus 1/2 plus 1/6, which gives you minus 1/3. So in this sense, the generators of electromagnetism are a subgroup of this full of this global symmetry group. But they're a special subgroup in that, unlike the rest of the symmetry group, this is a gauge subgroup, which means that we're treating the subgroup, the stuff in the subgroup, differently from the total story. So this is an explicit break-in. Now, if we apply these transformations to the pi field in the form of L sigma R dagger, this corresponds to setting T left plus T right. This corresponds to transforming by something within SE2V. And you can show that this corresponds, if you look at how things transform under this subgroup of the global symmetry group, well, first of all, and this is something you have to make sure of, this subgroup isn't spontaneously broken by the quark expectation value, because this piece lies within the vector subgroup. I have T left equals T right. But on top of that, if you apply this to the pi fields, you see that the pi 3 field corresponds to something with zero electric charge, so we'll call it pi 0. And you can show that the linear combinations pi 1 minus plus I pi 2 times 1 over root 2 have electric charge, correspond to things with electric charges of plus or minus 1 half, or plus or minus 1. So the upshot of this is that I started with these pi 3 field, these pi a fields, where a is 1, 2, 3. And these linear combinations correspond, if you like, to the eigenstates of the electromagnetic operator. And we identified these things with the neutral pion. And we identified these with the charge pions. And very nicely, if you look at the QCD excitations that are the lightest QCD excitations that we know of are, in fact, the neutral and charged pions, with everything else being a fair bit heavier. So our correspondence between this theory of Goldstones and reality is that these states we identify with the pions. So in this sense, the pions we see in hadronic excitations correspond to Goldstone bosons of approximate flavor symmetry. OK, so one other thing we'd like to do is fix this F parameter. So how does the F parameter correspond to physical observables? So this comes in. So to make sense of this F observable, we're going to go through an intermediate step, which is to match up currents. And what I mean by that is our top theory, our quark and gluon theory, has these sets of global symmetries. And we can write down symmetry currents corresponding to those global symmetries. So for example, corresponding to this vector U1, it corresponds to Q bar gamma mu Q. Up. Okay. So corresponding to my SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1V, global symmetries, you can show that the corresponding Miller currents are this, this, and that. Now, I can also construct Miller currents within my effective field theory in the same way. So my effective field theory has the same set of, my effective field theory has built into it the same set of global symmetries. They're realized nonlinearly, but they're still present. So I can also write down Noether currents within the effective field theory. So the Noether currents within the effective field theory are a bit more complicated, and it takes some work to be able to build them out. But in terms of the pion fields, you can show that they correspond to the following combinations. OK, so these specific expressions are not super useful, but OK. Well, at least in principle, I could derive these using Noether's theorem applied to the effective field theory in exactly the same way as I derive these using Noether's theorem applied to the full theory. Trace. OK, so I have these currents. And we can take these currents and use the fact that these currents are describing the same physics, but just in a low energy point of view versus a high energy point of view. So physically, these high energy currents should match up to these low energy currents, because this is a low energy effective field theory that's describing the low energy degrees of freedom derived from this high energy theory. So physically, the currents are describing the same thing, but in different languages appropriate to each regime. OK. So next, let's think about how a charged pion decays. A charged pion decays at the level, you can think of a charged pion decaying at the level of quarks as, so for example, if I have a pi minus, I can think of this as a down quark part in the pi minus going to an up quark through a W. It goes to a muon and a muon neutrino. So in terms of the quark picture, my pi minus my pi minus looks a little bit like the down quark and the anti-up quark annihilating into an off-shell W going to muon neutrino. So in our quark picture, this is how we'd understand the decay of a pi minus, where these things glomp up into a single bound state. So the actual description of this is hard. But what we can say is that there's some non-zero matrix element bar mu nu, and some interaction Hamiltonian that connects the pi minus with a given momentum to this final state. And in the quark picture, we'd write the interaction Hamiltonian in the following form. There's some effective four fermion operator that you get from integrating out the W. That has the following form. So in our quark picture, mediated by a massive W, since the W is massive, we can integrate it out. But this is the leading four fermion vertex you get. The pi minus should decay through an operator of this form. So this gives the leptonic final state. And this is the thing that's connecting the quarks in the initial state. Now, the complicated piece is we don't necessarily know how these quarks match up to the pi minus state, because you have strong coupling effects. But what we can do is, so we take this matrix element. We plug in this. We know how to deal with this part. The leptonic part is weakly interacting. And we just contract up these fields with this. So this thing, morally, I can factorize it into a leptonic piece that we can treat perturbatively that looks like mu bar gamma mu PL nu mu So this is a leptonic piece. So leptonic piece factorizes. And then you have a hadronic piece. So the hadronic piece is going to look like a vacuum final state with the quark operator gamma mu PL D acting on the pi minus field, the momentum P. So all that I'm getting at here is if you were to think about dealing with this operator between, let's say, a U bar D initial state and a muon neutrino final state, if I didn't have strong coupling, I know how to deal with everything. I just contract up all the fields. I put in this this operator here, contract up all the fields, and I get the U bars and V bars and U's and V's and this and that, and you just go to town. So the same procedure works for the leptons because they're weakly coupled. So this is a standard thing that you do in perturbation theory. But the whole U bar V contracting up stuff doesn't work in the strongly coupled case because of strong coupling. And because this piece doesn't exactly correspond to a U bar D thing. So we don't know what this is, but what we can do is use a combination of Lorentz invariance and dimensional analysis and write down and parameterize the form this has to take. So it turns out that the only thing this can be, the only momentum around to depend on is P, and that's the only four vector, and this thing under Lorentz transforms like a four vector. So this thing has to take the following form. Just because it's the only four vector we have around for it to depend on. And then the f pi over root 2 is just something we put in to get the dimensions right. So the lepton piece we deal with in the usual way. I would have, if this is p2 and that's p3, I would have a u bar of p2. Gamma mu PL V of P3 from the lepton piece. So we know how to deal with this. And then this thing gets wedged in with this piece. So as you see, because we have an external boson here, there's no sense of fermion polarizations. But all we can do is parameterize this in its most general form, which is that. Yeah.
So what was the justification in inserting the vacuum?
Oh, I'm putting in the vacuum here just in the sense that this piece factorizes from this, and that these two pieces shouldn't talk to each other. And this is also what you get just in perturbation theory if I could treat this as an up-down quark state. So I mean, you just contract everything up and contract up the fields and this and that. So okay, the vacuum is a bit of a cheat, but it's just reflecting the fact that this thing is equal to the lepton part and the hadronic part independently. Okay, so okay, or if you like, another way to think about this is the vacuum for hadronic states, this is the vacuum for leptonic states, and if I have something in a hadronic state and I try to tack on any leptonic operator, I'm going to get something that's zero. So that's all I'm getting at. OK, so this is our matrix element. And so we know how to compute this. And that means that we can compute a decay rate. And we can use this decay rate to fix the value of f pi. But the other thing we can do is look at this piece. And this piece turns out to have the form of one of the J mu left current operators. So in particular, you can show that U bar gamma mu PLD can be expressed in terms of these currents. In particular, it's J1 mu left plus J2 mu of left in this form. But remember that these currents are describing the same physics, but just with a different description. So this is the description that's useful for high energies. This is a description that's useful for lower energies. And that means that this piece connects up, should be the same thing as this thing, just written in terms of different variables. So now this piece, if you expand out, if you expand out the various current operators, this piece you'll see has a form of a del mu pi with a ta and an f. So it corresponds to one derivative acting on a pi field, and then some group theory stuff. But I have one derivative and one pi field plus higher order things. So the leading piece in this current in this other hadronic picture is this thing. When you work out everything, corresponds to 1/2 f del mu pi minus. Okay, in principle there can be higher order stuff, but this is the leading term.
The fact that it's one and two component means J1 and J2 corresponds to pi minus.
So the one and two come from these A things, and then so we have these A things, and then we have the correspondence between pi plus minus and pi 1 plus I pi 2, and it turns out the combination you get when you sum J mu 1 plus J mu 2 at leading order is a pi minus. And this makes sense from the point of view of electromagnetism, because the net charge of this is minus 1. So in principle, I could get higher order terms with 1 pi minus and some number of pi plus pi minus combinations, but this is the leading piece. So we take this, and we match this thing with this thing. So now in our low energy effective theory, as long as our momentum is a fair bit less than f, our effective theory is perturbative. And within our effective field theory, we can match up this piece with this piece and use the fact that we expect 0 u bar gamma mu pl dl 0. I should put a pi plus here. Actually, sorry, this should be pi minus p. Okay, sorry, I've already written that, but sorry. Let me erase this, I'm getting mixed up. So the point at the end of the day, though, is that if I look at this and I look at this, if I match this operator with the thing coming in over here, I could also contract up this thing directly with the pi minus here. And contracting up that thing from this picture would tell me that the thing I would get from that contraction would be a I over root 2 f p mu. So I've been a bit confusing here. So here we've just parametrized the general form of this matrix element in terms of what we have. On the other hand, here we've taken the form of the u bar gamma mu pld in terms of the pi minus. And if we were to take this and sandwich it between a 0 and a pi minus p, we would get out this thing. So the point is that this thing then has to match up with this thing. And our conclusion is that our f constant in our effective field theory coincides with this f pi that we measure in pi on decay. So the way we extract this experimentally is you compute the decay rate of the pion into mu on neutrino, and that fixes the value of this f pi. So that means that our f constant in our effective field theory corresponds to the so-called pion decay constant f pi, which numerically takes a value of about 93 MeV. So the physical interpretation of the f constant appearing in our effective field theory, which when we wrote down the effective field theory at the start, it was just some dimensionful constant we stuck in to get to make the full sigma field dimensionless, where our pi field had dimension 1. We see that it comes out corresponding to this pi on decay constant, 93 MeV. And this matches up. This is something we determine experimentally. But if we just do, if we think about the size of this, this isn't so different from Landau QCD. It's a bit smaller, but it's in the same ballpark. OK, so we're starting to connect our effective field theory of Goldstones with physical pions. Now, there's one more thing that we need to put in. OK, well, there are several more things, but let's start with one. One more thing we can put in is that we started off with an idealized QCD theory. So our idealized QCD theory didn't have any mass terms, and we only had two flavors. So for now, let's stay with two flavors, but let's think about what happens when you put in masses. Okay, so recall that we had mu is equal to about 2.5 MeV, if I remember right, and MD is something like 5 MeV. So both small numbers compared to lambda QCD, and also both fairly small compared to fpi. So we can add this to our QCD Lagrangian in the following form. We could write Q bar M where our M matrix is diagonal with diagonal elements MU and MD. So if I expand that out in terms of my original Q left and Q right fields, this obviously gives me the standard up and down quark masses. But one thing we see from this is that these terms are not invariant under our SU2 cross left, SU2 right global symmetry. Because here I'd have an L dagger R, here I'd have an R dagger L, and L M R dagger is not invariant because these diagonal elements are not the same. But what we can do now is think of this as a small breaking of that global symmetry. So it's a small breaking in the sense that the global symmetry is spontaneously broken at lambda QCD, which is much higher than the scale of these masses. So we can treat this perturbatively as a small correction. And treating this as a small correction, one way to keep track of it as a small correction is to think of this as a spurion. So in other words, we use our spurion trick, and we quote unquote pretend that M transforms as well, and that M transforms to R M L dagger. So actually, just to make this consistent, I should put a dagger here, just to keep track of what's the M and what's the M dagger. So okay, well, for our original matrix, M dagger is equal to M, but this form makes it easier to keep track of the transformations. So we see that if we have an M here and an M dagger here, and we apply a left-right transformation. Let's say you look at this piece. Here I'm going to have an R dagger. Here I have an R, M, L dagger, L. And this piece is invariant if I also pretend that my M transforms as well. So this is going to be our spurion trick. So we know that M doesn't really transform, but I will have the symmetry if M did transform this way. So the way to keep track of this breaking is to enforce this as a symmetry of my theory, including the M term, provided it also transforms in this way. So if I look at the leading term, I can write down in my effective field theory that is consistent with this pretend symmetry, including M. It turns out that the leading term I can write down has the following form: trace M sigma plus Hermitian conjugate. So remember, my sigma goes to L sigma R dagger. So M times sigma, when I take its trace, everything cancels out, and this is invariant. This lambda tilde cubed is some new dimensionful thing that I have to put in to get the dimensions to work out. And we're going to expect that it comes out close to lambda QCD, but we'll come back and check this. So I have to put in some new dimensionful constant. This already has dimension 1. This is dimensionless. So this has dimension 4. Everything works. And I put in the Hermitian conjugate. So this is invariant, provided I assume this pretend symmetry holds. And this is a valid term I can write down in my action, in my Lagrangian. So you can take this and expand it out. And the form of this, when I expand it out, the leading non-trivial term that's real when I add the Hermitian conjugate is going to give me a mass for the pion. So this thing, when I expand it out, has the form of, it's going to give me something when I expand it out of the form, m pi squared pi squared. Okay, so I guess I should write it pi a squared. But this quadratic term is going to take the form of 1/2. I'm going to be stuck with 3 powers here. That doesn't disappear. And I'm going to get a power of f. Oh, sorry. On this side, I'm going to get a power of mu plus fd. And then I get a 1 over f squared. Okay, I'm making a mess of this, but OK. So what I mean to say is that I can think of this two ways. When I expand this out, I'm going to get a term. The leading term turns out to be quadratic in the pi fields. And it takes the following form. It takes the form of an mu plus md times sigma tilde squared times a 1 over f squared with a pi a squared. So the 1 over f squared just comes from expanding out the pi's. The mu plus md comes from the m part. And then this lambda tilde cube piece comes from the new dimensional thing. So the point is that this is a pion mass term. And this pion mass term is what we call m pi squared in the usual way. So we identify this with the pion masses. So we know that the physical pions of QCD aren't exactly massless. And okay, they better not be. So if they're exact Goldstones, they would be massless. But we know they're not massless. And a way to understand they're not being massless is the fact that we have a small correction to this global symmetry from the explicit mass terms. And this is how the masses come out. So this is usually rewritten as f pi squared m pi squared is equal to lambda tilde cubed mu plus md. So we know what these things are. We know what this is. We know what this is. And then that fixes this. And this thing is on the order of roughly lambda QCD cubed. Not exactly, but sort of in the right ballpark. OK. So we have a nice description of low energy, of at least the charge in the neutral pions. Of course, there are lots of other QCD states. And the lots of other QCD states are going to take a little bit more work. But I'm not going to go through exactly how that works, but I'm just going to sketch it out. Yeah, Deepa.
So in this description, the masses of the 3 pions are degenerate, right?
Yeah, so actually, I'll get to that in a second. So yeah, so in nature, the pions have masses. And the pion masses aren't all the same. So there, if I remember right, the neutral pion is about 135, and the charged is like 140. Right, it's 130 and 135. But anyway, their mass separation is about 5 MeV, but their total scale is about 130 MeV. So this only includes the mass. This is a leading mass correction. A second explicit breaking that I mentioned before of this effect comes from the fact that I've gauged a subgroup of the full global symmetry group. So because of electromagnetism also represents an explicit breaking of the symmetry. And those electromagnetic splittings split the masses of the charged and neutral pions beyond what I just get here. So it turns out that you get a consistent story when you include all this stuff. I also mentioned at one point that you can consider an axial U1. This axial U1 turns out to have an anomaly. And so for example, I have this so-called symmetry current that seems to be conserved classically, but isn't conserved in the quantum theory. When you compute loops, you find that its divergence is not quite zero. So it turns out that the divergence of that thing being not quite zero leads to an effective vertex between the pi zero, and 2 photons. And it turns out that this anomaly-induced vertex is actually the leading way for the pi zero to decay. but okay, this is getting a bit far afield. But if you look at my notes, I have various references to discussions that do this in more detail. Okay, and just okay. So let me just finish up the QCD part, and then we'll get into exotic strong coupling and technicolor theories tomorrow. But the one last thing I wanted to mention is that here we included only the up and down quarks, but we also have the strange quark with a mass of about 110 MeV. And then, okay, beyond this, you have the charm quark, which is about 1.2 GeV, and the bottom quark, which is about 4.5 GeV. So for the charm and the bottom quark, there isn't really any sense in which these masses are small compared to lambda QCD. Whereas for the strange quark, it's about the same size as lambda QCD, maybe a little bit, maybe a bit smaller. But it turns out that it's still often useful to treat this as a small correction to the global symmetry theory. But now, by including the strange quark, instead of having SU2 cross SU3, we have, SU2 cross SU2. If you include the strange quark explicitly, the global symmetry group expands to SU3 cross SU3 right cross U1V. And the SU3s mix up, down, and strange. And now my Q left, right would be combining everything into an up. Like so. So again, if I'm treating electromagnetism as a small correction, and I'm treating the masses as a small correction, this is a sensible thing to do. It looks a bit funny in terms of electromagnetism because I've got different stuff, but okay, I won't worry about that. So it turns out that you can go through the same procedure we did here, but now including this SU3 story. And now your pion fields are going to live in SU3. This pi ATA is now going to be a 3x3 matrix. And you can show that in terms of components, it's going to correspond to more states that work out pretty nicely. So you can show that. So let me just try to write all the stuff out. So my pi minus lives here. My k minus lives here. My pi plus lives here. My k bar 0 lives here. My k 0 lives here. OK, actually, sorry. I just erased this. And then up here, I have a k plus. So the kaons in the eta are additional mesons that you see in QCD that involve the strange quark. So sometimes people will talk about a stranger's quantum number. But if you apply the same techniques to this SU3 symmetric case, this is what my set of would-be Goldstone bosons look like. The approximation of treating these as approximate Goldstones works very well for the pions. It works a little bit less well for the kaons. So for example, kaon masses are on the order of 400-450 MeV. So this is kind of pushing it compared to lambda QCD. But this is often still a good approximation. And you can relate various decay matrix elements for one kind of pion to another based on the approximate SU3 cross SU3 symmetry. So you can take the same procedure and apply it to the other kaons. But this is about the limit of this formalism. Beyond that, there's not really any good sense that you include the charm or the bottom quarks, and obviously not the top. OK, so I'll basically wrap it up there. I'll say a few more things and then move on to technicolor tomorrow. But the idea, what we're going to do, just to give you the punchline before we start, is that we see that this quark matrix element breaks this SU2 left cross SU2 right piece. And if I think about the standard model, it turns out that suppose I had a standard model without a Higgs, or at least without a Higgs that got an expectation value. If you think about this quark expectation value, the Q bar J, QI, in terms of the standard model, this SU2 left that I've written down, this so-called flavor symmetry, is actually gauged, and we identify it with the SU2 left of a weak force. So as far as this QCD effective field theory discussion goes, we just treated it as a global symmetry. But if you have unbroken weak gauge symmetry, it's actually gauged. And you can see, if you think about it a little bit, this quark bilinear expectation value spontaneously breaks SU2 left. And it turns out that it would give you spontaneous SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge breaking into U1 of electromagnetism. And this is great. The only problem is that your W and Z masses would be on the order of lambda QCD. And this is obviously not what we see. But the idea of technicolor theories is you take the structure, you scale it up to order 100 GeV or so, and you use that to break electric symmetry, break the electric symmetry without a Higgs. So we'll come back to that tomorrow.